Hi, this is Joanna Bond. I'm the Dean of Rutgers Law School, and you're listening to the Power of Attorney podcast. It's my great pleasure to introduce you today to Chair and CEO of New Jersey's Civil Service Commission and 1999 Rutgers Law School graduate, Allison Chris Myers, who's also the first openly transgender state cabinet member. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me to join your show. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. It's such an honor to have you here. And one of the things that we usually start out with on these podcast episodes is a question that asks you about your origin story. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in Cumberland County in a town called Bridgeton in South Jersey. And I continue to live in the county and work here. I grew up in the early 70s. And when I finished high school, I wasn't quite sure what to do with myself. I was working in a factory, one of the glass factories over in Millville, doing laborer work. And then on the weekends, I was loading trucks. And I didn't have really a lot of money or anything to go to school. So, and I wanted to try to transition basically to learn a profession of some sort. So I enlisted in the Navy. I usually kid that I wanted to find a job where I could work in an office, because I would see the foreman's office on the factory floor in the middle of the graveyard shift over over in Millville during the middle of the summer in a sweltering heat. And that was someplace you could go in there and you'd see the people working in air conditioning, looking comfortable, and you weren't like getting off of that leer. You know, you couldn't just like leave the wear would fall off in the ground. I was like, it would be great to work in an office.
Right. So, oh yeah, absolutely. The availability of air conditioning alone is pretty attractive at the
point. It was huge. But it was a way to learn a skill, as well as to, for me, save some money for college, as well as, you know, I come from a family of folks that all my brothers and sisters and my father served in the one of the branches of the military for at least one term. So, you know, we were very public spirited that way. So I wanted to continue that tradition as well, to be quite frankly, all kidding aside. So I enlisted and I became what was called a personnelman in the Navy. And that's the individual that works with the personnel function for whatever kind of command that you're with, all the enlisted service records and transfers and orders and leave management and all these kinds of human resourcey kinds of things. So I was trained to do military personnel in Meridian, Mississippi. And when I was finished my training in Mississippi, I was stationed with an F-14 squadron at then NAS Miramar in San Diego. Now, you got to remember, it was 1986 when I went. And right as I was, you know, reporting to that base, to my command, they had finished filming the movie Top Gun, the first Top Gun at that base.
I was thinking that the timing would match up with the first Top Gun.
Yeah. And, right. And the actual Top Gun school, Navy Fighter Weapons School, was three hangars down from the squadron that I was assigned to. So that was kind of fun and a big deal at the time.
Must have been exciting.
Oh, it was a blast, and it was a really good experience for me, and it helped me gather and gain a lot of the maturity I think a person needs to attend college. Actually, I don't know if I would have done well in college without that type of discipline and structure that the military gives you. Mm-hmm. So I saved every penny I could. Because my actual dream was to go to Rutgers College in New Brunswick, I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was I know I wanted to work in, we call it human resources now, but back then it was personnel. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I could, you know, work in some type of administrative personnel type of position and then go and learn and get a college degree, I should be able to get a nice position and start my career in the personnel field. So I was very fortunate in the military. And this is really where I started an interest or found an interest in the legal aspects of the employment situation. And one of the things that I eventually was assigned to do was to prepare the cases for Article 15 matters that went before the CO regarding disciplinary matters and discharges for misconduct and things like that. I mean, I certainly didn't do the hearing or was the officer or anything that did those, but what I did was I did the research and put the packages together so they could make their determinations. Not quite a legal brief, but close enough to whet my interest in the possibility of someday considering law school. So when I got out of the service, I came back home to Cumberland County and attended what's now called Rowan College of South Jersey, but back then it was Cumberland County College. I got out of the military in December and I started in January and finished the course in a year. I went all summer and took a full, back then you could take a full course load of up to 21 credits for the same amount of money.
Wow. That's incredible.
So I took, you know, and I was able to get through my associate's program there by December. And I transferred to Rutgers College in on a cold January day, actually, is what it was. My girlfriend, who's now been my wife for 30 years, I can remember her bringing me and dropping me off up there.
Oh, wow.
To the housing where I stayed, you know, for the first term.
Did you continue to study in the HR kind of space?
What I did was I studied, it was a field called labor studies. And what that was a study of, it was the study of the American labor movement, including things like collective negotiations, ERISA law, some basic contract law, OSHA, those types of worker rights types of matter. You know, we learned about the Public Employee Relations Commission, those types of things, and did those kinds of mock cases. So I thought it was like a really great approach because at the county college, I had earned an associate's in business administration. So I thought this way it was a nice balance between kind of management and labor by pursuing my course of study this way. So I graduated and started looking for a job and I couldn't find a job.
Is that why you decided to go to law school at that point?
No, law school came later for me.
Okay.
So, and I was really disappointed, I remember, because I thought, wow, you know, I had some practical experience kind of work. I mean, I know it's not private sector human resources, but it was something. I thought I could get a start in with a bachelor's degree because I never even thought at one point I would be able to go to college. And it was nice having those. And I thought, wow, this is like the ultimate package.
Right.
So I'm looking and looking and I can't find anything. And I finished school in the summer, actually, because I had to take a summer half of the summer session to get the credits that I needed to get done earlier. Cause I only stayed at Rutgers it ended up being like a year and a half is what I needed to do there.
Okay.
So, beginning of the summer in June, I started looking for work, nothing. So by the time I finished the first, I had to do the first summer session at the time. I had no prospects.
Oh, that's so discouraging.
Oh, it was very discouraging. I was like, what am I going to do? Well, you got to work.
Right.
So I started applying for other types of positions. And I got a position with a medical healthcare utilization review company, which are the folks that do like pre-certification when you call in for a hospital stay or a procedure. But the other side of the business was written record reviews for medical insurance carriers to adjudicate cases where they want to challenge the claim, the claimants for medical necessity, or if it's causally related, if it's a workers' comp claim or pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. And I was actually hired in the marketing department, and not to sell the stuff. They need a marketing clerk. And that's what I started as. And I thought, okay, it's great. It's, you know, I'm not loading trucks, so that's a wonderful thing.
And you were probably in an air-conditioned office.
And I was in an air-conditioned office. So it's funny, about 6 months into my job there, I got friendly with, you know, the lady that hired me. And I asked her, I said, you know, like, why did, like, you pick me to do this job? I mean, was it because of my college degree and military service and all that? And Maggie turned around and looked at me and said, the most attractive thing about you as a candidate was you knew how to type.
Oh, no. I'm sure that's not the answer you were looking for.
And I was like, I learned how to type in high school, ninth grade.
Right. I didn't spend all those years in college on that.
You know, so, but it was a good experience for me there. I ended up being there for about 10 years, actually, and I'd moved my way up.
Oh, that's great.
And during my last 4 years there, I was kind of getting itchy to do something because it was kind of a litigation-based business. Sure. At least we provided like expert reports in the areas where I had worked, right? And we were just a clearinghouse. We arranged with medical providers to get the specialties that they needed for the different challenges and stuff. Not really legal work in itself, but kind of still on the peripheral. And I still always had this, I really always wanted to work in personnel. So I could see just as an, you know, working in business as and being an employer, look, you know, moving up to the system, how much the law interacts in the employment relationship.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, kind of like in real time.
Right.
So I thought, well, okay, this would be, maybe now's the time to explore going to law school. So.
And was this early 90s, mid 90s? It must have been mid 90s, right?
Yeah, it was the mid 90s. Yes. Okay. So I applied to Rutgers Law School and to the night program in Camden. And I was accepted.
Great.
And I went through the 4-year night school program after work.
And you continued at that same company? Okay.
Yeah. The place where I'd worked, it was actually in Mount Laurel. Then it moved, right? Which was wonderful. It moved to Pennsauken off of 130.
Okay.
And my wife and I only had one car at the time.
So it helped that you were close by.
Right. I mean, we lived down here though, right? Right. So we would, you know, she worked in Mount Laurel and I worked in Pennsauken. So she would drop me off or whatever. But when I started school, we really couldn't do that anymore because I had to go to school after work. So there was happened to be a bus line that ran from the old medic building, which is where I had worked off of 130, all the way down to Camden. And I got off two blocks over from the school. And, you know, so I was able to make like the first class. And usually there was, you know, two classes that you would do, like 3-hour sessions.
And did you take the bus back home after classes?
Yes, I did. I took the bus home, the 408 down to Millville. And it was... And what was the kind of the challenging part was my last class got done, I don't know, like at 9:30 or something. You know, it was late.
That is late.
Right. And I had to run the two blocks over to get the 406. And it was the last one coming to Millville for the night. No.
And there was no standing around after class to ask questions of the professor.
No, like I had to run over because it was, I don't know, I don't remember the exact times. But it was like 10 minutes after class left, I had to be over there.
Right.
And run over there, and I was able to take the bus home, and it took about an hour to get the bus down to where I live because, you know, it goes all over the place when it's picking, dropping people off and stuff. But I found that it was good time to kind of decompress, and I could start some of my reading assignments because, as you know, there is a ton of reading
right in
law school. So eventually we had moved. Lori's my wife. We had bought a house, and I ended up starting to take the bus to work from down here.
Okay.
Because it was more effective, because that way I could get my study time in on the commute up. So I'd take the bus to Camden, then just get the 409 to which actually ends up in Trenton, but it goes up 130, and I could get off, go to work. But I had all that time to be able. That's really when I did most of my reading and outlining for your listeners.
That's fantastic.
It was on the bus and on weekends. And what was really cool, at least during my first year, and I don't know if you do this now, but for legal research and writing, it was the first time that the Camden campus at least explored doing this, was they had a Saturday class for that instead of, it was an option. The night one else could have either taken this section at night that met like twice a week or whatever, or this day one on Saturday mornings for one time a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up doing that for the legal research and writing, but it made for a lot of, good times.
I'm sure.
And
well, let me ask you a question about your Rutgers Law School experience. What was it about Rutgers Law School that drew you to Rutgers specifically?
I love Rutgers, period. That's all I ever thought about, was going to Rutgers College when I left actually for the military. That's where I wanted to go. And I looked at it as the crowning achievement for a young then boy in down Jersey to be able to make it. I mean, mm-hmm. Going to Rutgers, at least in my mind, it was like you're going to the big city.
Right.
And you're close to so many things and so much opportunity. And there was so much to learn there. And the experience was just so wonderful. So I've always loved Rutgers, period. And specifically for law school, a huge draw was the programming at the time. What I particularly liked about Rutgers Law School in Camden, it was not only the facility and the proximity for my life outside of school, where I could work and get there easily, but it was really more for the programming. They had the four-year night school program with, I think it was one summer you had to go, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the required courses for all the 1Ls was tax law. Not that I got into a lot of it, but I thought, you know, there was a good consciousness of a sound, firm legal education with the basics to jump off of any other area of law. And for some reason, that just always stuck with me as being like a huge deal. Because mm-hmm. at the time, and I don't know if the law schools do it now, but it was the only program that I knew of that required that particular course of all
That's
the 1Ls.
It's so interesting to me that you got in the weeds enough in your research to discover that was a unique part of the Rutgers curriculum.
Yes. And they even had, I mean, I didn't participate in it because I didn't have an interest to go that way, but there was like a tax honors program at the time, I remember.
Interesting.
You know, so I thought it would provide a wonderful base, like I said, but as well as like a springboard really to be able to serve the citizens of New Jersey, because I love living in New Jersey, and I particularly love where I live down here in down Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And Rutgers is really like part of who we are as residents of New Jersey.
Right.
And
absolutely.
You know, so there was kind of just this emotional attachment to it, just like I said, generally, but for the law program, it was really for the foundation, the foundational courses and that was like the biggest thing. And very, and the support structure at the school was wonderful, I recall, because particularly for the night school students. I mean, I don't know what it was like to be there during the day, but you know, we always had access to all of our professors, and they always very reachable. Would, you know, it wasn't like the paper chase.
That's good. Well, I'm so glad to hear that professors were accessible, and you know, that the school was conscious of providing support services for evening students. We still do that. We're very, very conscientious about that, and really make an effort to ensure that evening students are included as well.
And you know, some of the instructors that we had were, I mean, there really were known quantities, actually, even at the time. For evidence, I had Jack Sabatino, who's on the appellate bench now.
Oh, great.
Who, you know, was just amazing.
Yeah.
Judge King with appellate practices.
Well, I'm going to shift gears for us. And let's do a softball round robin.
Okay.
So what was your favorite and least favorite class in law school? I'm going to guess favorite was administrative law, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, it was. I loved administrative law. And the second closest one to that was New Jersey constitutional law.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Okay. And least favorite?
Torts and criminal procedure.
Right. Just not an interest for you.
No. And the thing is, it's like, you know, after going through civil procedure as a 1L and stuff, which is challenging, it really is. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, well, you know, criminal procedure will be a little more relatable or something, you know. I'd rather take 10 classes in civil procedure than ever doing another criminal, because that I just couldn't seem to grasp it or have an interest in it the same
right.
way.
Right.
And it wasn't like it was a bad instructor or anything like that. The gentleman was wonderful. It was just, I really just did not care for the subject matter when I got into the class.
Right. Understandable. Well, and I think that's one of the great things about law school is you really do over time figure out what it is about the law that excites you and resonates with you. And so, you know, you figure that out by taking classes that you either love or don't love.
Right. And that it was interesting too, because like, yeah, you know, I remember thinking at one point, because whenever I took administrative law, it was a little closer to the end of what would have been my second year if I was a traditional day student. And prior to that, I had other, you know, like I can't remember what they called it at the time, but it was basically like ERISA at the course. And after I took the admin law class, I'm thinking, I wish I had the admin law first, because I think I would have understood agency operations and interpretation a little better if I had that earlier on in my law school career.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because it would have helped me with other kind of like agency specific courses that I had that dealt with an agency interpreting and enforcing a particular statute.
Great. And just for the sake of our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you just mention briefly what ERISA is?
It's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And it covers basically your pension programs, the rules that pension programs need to apply, go by.
Okay, fantastic.
And the interest was, you know, because that's an employment type of benefit, and
it's right up your alley.
Yeah right. it was really wonderful.
All right, so going back to our softball round robin, favorite place to eat nearby campus?
Okay, well, do you know the Camden campus?
Yes.
Okay, so remember, I was in there in the evening, so not a lot of places to eat in Camden at the evening during that time. There've been a lot of building and stuff since then. I know. So there was an old brownstone. It was rather close to the law school, but you know, it was a short walk.
Okay.
It was an old brownstone, and that was the law school student center.
Oh, it was an official student center.
Mm-hmm. and yet nobody ever went to it. And you had to push these buttons to get in the back door. They gave you like the security code.
Okay.
And it was actually there because I would bring my dinner with me to, and eat in there and study in there before class. Or if we had study groups that would get together on the weekends, we would use some of the rooms in the law school student center.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't know if it was used a lot during the day or not, but it was never, nobody was ever in there, and there was couches and stuff. And I took a few naps there between, you know, after work, but before class and stuff. But that was probably my favorite place to eat because I was able to read and quiet, and when you get together and go through outlines and stuff, you know, on a Saturday or have a study group or whatever, you know, it was a lot of fond memories because, you know, of course there's like always food associated with stuff like that.
Of course. Absolutely. Well, those things don't change. That's still true today.
Right. So, you know, and that was kind of like closest to the, you know, college experience or whatever that I had.
Right. Sure.
So it was a lot of fond memories with that particular building, actually.
That's great. Okay, so what do you think was the most important thing that you learned at Rutgers Law School?
Tenacity.
Fantastic. Can you expand on that a little bit?
A problem, I really learned that a problem doesn't always have one answer or one point of view or a different way to even consider or how to, or not necessarily unearth all of the facts, because I would have preconceived notions about things. And the whole process of being challenged with the Socratic method and working with a bunch of people that are going to be in lawyers, it was really mind expanding. And you really had to be tenacious, or learn to be tenacious, to deal with this and accept the fact that, hey, wait a minute, I'm not really wrong about this. This is a learning experience because this is what I didn't consider, and this would be beneficial to keep this in mind with, you know, in dealing with your clients, actually, because so just that kind of overall process. And it's hard to go through it, at least for me it was at first, because it's like, oh, you think you're the, you know, you do well basically in college and in work or whatever, and you know, you're always right.
You think you have all the answers, right?
And you think you have all the answers, and you really don't. And once I stepped away from my ego being hurt, it was very mind opening, and it's benefited me greatly.
That's so great to hear.
It was really like the tenacity to go through a bunch of different cases, or cases from competing circuits that were differing, you know, and you could see how the judge got there in each of the case, but you know, someone's got to be. So that particular exercise was ultimately the best one for me.
That's
it helped
great.
Me the most in my personal life, and as well as in my legal education.
I can see how it would. That's a fantastic quality. And were there ways in which your legal education really helped prepare you for your career in government?
Yeah. Yes, it did. I was still working at HealthQuest when I graduated from law school. And I kind of figured out that I wanted to work in public service at that point. And basically, it was because of my law school experience. I started thinking of public service after undergraduate, you know, like working with the National Labor Relations Board or something like that. And it didn't really quite work out that way for me. But I started looking for government service jobs dealing with in human resources now.
Right.
And how that this kind of education would be beneficial. So back in 1999, I was looking through a young internet job posting page for the former Department of New Jersey Department of Personnel, thinking, oh, you know, maybe there's different state jobs in employee relations or a human resource generalist, whatever, you know, because I never really wanted to argue like in front of a judge or anything like that, you know.
Right.
So I find this position for personnel and labor analyst training, and I read it, it's just like, oh, you know, know, we adjudicate cases on the written record and blah, blah, blah. And all you need is like a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied for it. So about a year later, I hear back from them, oh, you know, here's this, we're having this test up in Trenton. So I go and take the test. Now, you know, at this point, it's just like a year into the process, you know, I'm kind of thinking, you know,
right,
nothing's going to happen. So I get a call for an interview, right? And it was November of that year. And I go up, I interviewed, and they offered me a trainee position in December.
Okay.
And I started the trainee position in the beginning of January of 2001. So to go back to answer your question, okay. So I'm in the interview, and it was like most public service positions, it's a panel interview with different folks kind of assessing your answers against weighted questions.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's done, you know, do you have any questions? And basically what the division I ended up being hired for, we provided counsel and advice to the then Merit System Board of cases brought before it.
Okay.
Okay, so we would do the legal research and brief writing for the Merit System Board to make a final administrative determination on a matter under its jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked them, you know, we have this thing in law school called Westlaw. Do you have anything like that you use for Department of Merit System Board cases at the time?
Right.
And I'll never forget this. The guy that was interviewing me, it became like a wonderful mentor.
Okay.
He looks at me and says, he points his finger like two people down. He said, we just asked that guy because he has like a memory like to, and you could ask this guy like, oh, well, the Merit System Board reviewed this issue like in 1969, and he would just had this memory, and he could give you a site, and then you just have to go look for the case like in the files to see if you.
He was like a human Westlaw.
Right. It was like a human Westlaw, but you know, like you always need like the actual doc.
Right.
So I was like, oh, okay. You know, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, how do they do anything? You know?
Right.
So one of the things that, when I started the position and that's the way it was actually, you went to Peter for everything to do this. If the regs or whatever couldn't help you. And after a number of years of doing that, I started to develop a kind of like a Westlaw database of quote unquote precedential Merit System Board actions and began to put it together. And I was just doing this for my own. It was like a big course outline for law school. And I had different topic areas, you know, different taxonomy for it and everything. So my manager asked me one day, like, well, she asked me a question about like leaves of absence. Right. And I said, oh, well, you know, in Ray Fox, which was decided in 1988, you have to take a leave of absence from, you know, your permanent career service position to maintain a relationship with the career service. So if you get dismissed from your unclassified appointment, you can still fall back on your career service appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And Elizabeth looked at me like, you didn't work here in 1988. How the heck do you know that? So I told her about this thing that I had.
You created a system.
I created this system. And she encouraged me to share it with the division. And from that grew, we call it like the index, but we were able to centralize the system. And this is all before the time we started sending like our little final administrative decisions to LexisNexis now, because they sort of do it.
Okay.
At this point, but they never used to do this.
That didn't exist.
Right. At least, you know, at agency level stuff, you know.
Right.
There was like a digest, an old paper digest for OAL stuff. There was a reporter for a while, a paper reporter for a while, and they stopped that in the 90s, I think.
That's amazing. Times have changed.
But yeah, sure. But that was like the big thing. And it was something, you know, the taxonomy and the coding, a lot of it I lifted from the key system because, you know, it's like an area of practice that we have, you know, examinations, eligibility, announcements, different disciplinary issues.
Right.
I mean, you know, it goes on and there's different nuances. I mean, it's not a huge body of law, but it is one that we need. And all of our analysts now just kind of use it like second nature. And, but I learned that from law school and the importance of being able to research and find information.
Right.
That was like another big takeaway from law school is finding information, getting the facts straight, and then finding the law, right?
Yeah.
And it helped finding the quote unquote law, you know, because like in the administrative for something so policy driven as a lot of what civil service is, it's maybe there's more of an emphasis on this area or priority from one administration than another. So, but either kind of course is correct, but it's a matter of, you know, how you want to weigh things as a policy matter. So it served me well having such a tool because I would catalog and keep all of this information of how, I don't know, this was kind of like the practice in these areas that they wanted us to defend during the Christie administration. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the same area during the Corzine administration. And when the new decision makers would come in, we would have it and say, okay, this is kind of a history of what was done in the past. Full panoply, which is another word I learned in law school, panoply.
That's a good one.
This way, the decision makers would kind of have a complete history of what to do so they could make the best decision for whatever was before them in that topic area. So they would know all of the thinking on it. Because I truly believe in the civil service system as being independent of the political process as much as possible.
Speaking of the civil service profession, can you tell us a little bit about your current role as chair and CEO of New Jersey's Civil Service Commission?
Sure. What the chairperson and the CEO of the commission is, it's a cabinet level position that administers the overall selection process and adjudicatory process of employees of jurisdictions under the civil service system. So in a nutshell, what the agency does, the Civil Service Commission, which was formerly the Department of Personnel, they changed it back in 2008 to Civil Service Commission, is to classify different types of positions for jobs. Mm-hmm. And then what do those jobs do? What are the duties they do, kind of generally? And what are the knowledge, skills, and abilities that would take to successfully perform those jobs? So the agency creates a classification system. So different types of government work, they're classified into positions by what we call titles. And then there's different title series where you can incrementally move up to different areas or levels of responsibility within that title system. And civil service basically starts with that. Mm-hmm. Because our Constitution, which is unique among the states, actually mandates testing, if practical, for civil service appointments in the state.
Okay.
So you can't write a test if you don't know what you're writing a test about. So that's why you have to classify the positions, because you need to know how to build a test.
Right.
But it's more than just how to build a test to fairly compete. How do you compensate incumbents in that title based on the levels of knowledge, skills, and abilities, responsibilities, accountability, what you're bringing to the job, what the job requires. So you can't test and you can't really compensate without that.
Right.
So, makes sense. What else does civil service do? Okay, well, our enabling statute says we're supposed to reward performance based on meritorious performance and separate employees from service if on the basis of their performance, because this advances the overall public policy of the state to deliver services by individuals in the best manner possible. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in order to do that, you have to have these classification and then the testing mechanism, but you also need to know, okay, so if I'm a police officer and I'm late for work all the time and I start questioning, I'm insubordinate. And on the other side, say you're a principal clerk and you do the same thing. Should the level of potential punishment be the same based on the position and the accountability of the position? There's like a great public trust in our law enforcement officers. So the standard is a little different than it would be for a clerk, basically.
Right.
You know, what a clerk may do and what a police officer do, they may both be insubordination, but the officer is supposed to reflect a higher level of they are out there enforcing the law. They should be the example. These people can take your freedom away.
Right.
So
right.
There's a higher obligation and you kind of learn these things when we have to make penalty decisions on matters that come before us.
Right.
And it helps us understand those types of things as well, because the other part of what we do is like an adjudicatory function mm-hmm. for discipline, for removals, for layoff actions, if they're in good faith or not. We also there's discrimination claims that you can bring under our jurisdiction for a particular state policy that we administer to enforce equality in the law force and non-discrimination.
Okay.
So it's important to know all these things. So it all kind of fits together nicely in a personnel quasi type of personnel system that is kind of the umbrella, and once removed from the actual frontline HR, because when we produce a test that results in an employment list, really the HR function of hiring goes to the agency making the hire. Mm-hmm. And they have to do that in conformance with our law, of course, and there's different laws that govern, okay, you have to pick one of the top three on the list. Yeah, veterans' preference is absolute. There's certain ways you can remove people from the list, but you got to be able to make a case to do it. Our agency really provides these personnel tools to appointing authorities so they can do their jobs.
Okay.
Okay. So it's providing the tools and providing like an adjudication forum for disputes under the law.
That's fascinating. And so I want to pivot for a second to something that's a little bit more personal, but I know that the full expression of your identity happened just a few years ago during the pandemic. And now, as I mentioned earlier, you're the first openly transgender state cabinet member. So what has that experience been like from then to now?
It's been like a real whirlwind for me, quite frankly, and at times it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. For the last 22 years before I was blessed with this opportunity, I wasn't really forward facing to the public as far as it just like any other bureaucrat. You know, mm-hmm. I had cases to do, you know, and I moved up in that. I ended up being the director of the division where I worked, but you do legal research and writing pretty much all day, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, what's a little different is I'm out more talking to people about the good work of the Civil Service Commission and how we can further assist with whatever your employment needs are as they relate to the different programs that we are responsible for. So like, for example, it's tough to hire public safety positions now for various reasons.
Right.
You know, and there, if you're an employer looking to hire police officers, say, for example, traditionally you got to use the list, right, to make these offers. And well, it takes time to produce these lists. And then when you produce the list and there's different folks on there that may not be like the best candidate, well, can you remove them from the list for real? And can you, is there a good basis to do this? Are they psychologically fit? So the process can take months, years sometimes, but you need to fill a position today now.
Right.
And it's really become exaggerated since COVID because the employment market has become very tight. We are, just like the public sector, we are trying to fill positions at all levels of public service through our system. And the tools that we are creating aren't really meshing up with what the needs of the appointing authority are.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, they're not in a position where they can wait that long to make offers of employment or even start the process, because candidates now will move to another offer. They just can.
Right.
So what a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to meet and talk with these different appointing authorities in person to see what we can do within our statutory and constitutional restraints in order to try to improve this process, because public service is going to suffer unless we can get the best talent that we can to fill our facilities, our veterans homes, the folks at the DMV or Motor Vehicle Commission. I'm sorry, my age is showing. our hospitals that are for like the developmentally disabled, for the folks that works on the roads.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Well,
right, people will just not migrate to public service if it's like, well, you know, well, maybe you'll be reachable on a list, or we don't know, you know. And so we're looking to try to address and improve this, but getting in front of people and talking to them in that kind of manner has been the biggest thing in my life. These overall policy kinds of decisions now. Mm-hmm. I used to always say in DARA, which is the division where I work, Division of Appeals and Regulatory Affairs, you know, if I were queen for a day, I would do this. And it would just solve everything.
Right.
Well, now I'm sort of like
you're the queen end for of the day.
Decision making
right.
in my little world, I guess.
Right.
And it's goes back to that tenacity. There's really a lot of different views and outputs to consider now. And the only way that I know how to get out there and get that information is by having the rubber hit the road and talk to people.
Right.
You know, it's funny. For my particular journey, I spent most of my career as a man in the Department of Personnel Civil Service Commission. And a huge constituency of the agency are our public safety partners. Lots and lots of police and fire testing and disciplinary appeals and, you know, a very, very, it's a big chunk of our quote unquote business. And our collective bargaining partners are very, very involved in their membership.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that I had to do publicly was to address the FMBA members at one of their conventions in Atlantic City.
Wow. That's
now incredible. These are all mostly men.
Right.
And kind of like alpha men. You know, it's just like, I mean, you're really take charge kind of control person. If you're going to be running into a fire to save somebody's life, you know?
So was that a challenging moment for you?
That was a real challenging moment for me, right. Actually, I don't know how they're going to take me.
Right.
I'm 6'1" without my kitten heels on.
Right.
Okay. So I was really nervous. So I had to go up and speak at the dais. I didn't go to the dais. I walked down from the stage and addressed the members face to face from the floor on and talked to them that way.
Wow, that's powerful.
And I wanted to represent that it doesn't really matter who I feel I am as a gender or how I present myself. I have something to offer you with civil service for this particular parts of your lives. Let's have a discussion. Let's talk about what we need to talk about to better serve your needs, because you're going to be the guys possibly running into my house and saving my children if my house is on fire. So what can I do as in a support capacity to make you not have to worry about your civil service related junk? And I had guys speaking to me for like an hour, asking me questions and peppering me questions and stuff. But I was really scared. Mm-hmm. But I thought if I wanted to do this because, I always joke and say, I wanted to do that because I wanted to show that transgender people don't bite. But it was very rewarding. And, most folks are okay with it so far. Right. At least they've been to me.
That's great. I'm so glad to hear that.
And, been very, like I said, I wasn't really quite sure, because when I first started presenting full time, I did it in small circles, right? Mm. During COVID, for example, I was one of the few people that came into the office every day because of the level of my position. They needed senior staff there.
Sure.
Well, our senior staff is a limited number of people. You know what I mean? So
right.
I got comfortable with them. And then we started bringing staff back on a couple days a week when things started to lighten up and more people got acquainted and people talk,
Sure.
But they treated me wonderfully.
I'm so happy to hear that.
And, and they see me as a colleague, not as a, you decided to wear a dress to work one day, so they make you chairperson.
Right.
And that's like that's always been my biggest concern. When I was appointed, my nomination was, Governor Murphy, was so kind to nominate me. I learned very quickly, you don't read comments in social media on a politician's website, because some of the things were horrible.
Right. Absolutely.
And whatever I did for the last 22 years, if it was good, bad, or indifferent, at least according to the social commentators, I got this job because I was transgender and they needed a transgender person. And I feel like I really have to work hard to demonstrate that transgender people, or anybody really, doesn't matter if you're transgender or whatever, whatever mm-hmm. your religious beliefs are or your race or gender or whatever.
Right.
It's really the content of your character and what you do. It just doesn't disable me. I can still do stuff.
No, it enriches your experience and you bring wonderful things to the table. So I know that the governor recognized that and I'm so happy about that.
Yeah, I'm so fortunate. I never really thought, I thought I would just work in the appeal section until I retired,
right.
Basically. I never really pursued this or anything. It's just my predecessor wanted to retire and it kind of evolved from that. And I'm just so fortunate. I feel like one of the nice things about working in a division that does the adjudication work for all of the other divisions and the local appointing authorities that have civil service issues is you get a lot of exposure to how the other divisions do things, the processes of the agency, because you have to defend them. You got to get your facts straight first, right?
Right.
So you end up learning so much about the multifaceted roles of other people and other operations that are related to civil service. So I think that gives me at least an opportunity to have some of that knowledge to be able to know where we may be able to push the envelope a little bit to make improvements, where things are going fine. I think it gives, at least gives me an insight that way. And I hope to use it in such a way as to benefit our public servants and ultimately the public.
So, absolutely. Well, we're so thrilled that you're leading the commission, and we're so happy that you are a proud graduate of Rutgers Law School.
I am too. I am too. You know, I never thought I'd even when I remember applying as an undergraduate for Rutgers, and I was like, they're never going to accept me. I'm not smart enough.
Well, you've proved them wrong.
You know, and it was just like, oh my God, this is like so wonderful. I, you know, it was really a dream come true.
That's great.
For me. And then maybe it sounds trite now, but it's the God's honest truth.
I love that.
It really is. You know, it's just not like the school next door or whatever for me.
No, it's a special place. I agree.
It really is.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us, Chairperson Myers. This was a fantastic conversation, and I really appreciate you sharing your time with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it. And if there's ever anything, you know, I can do to help, or public service is always looking for law school graduates.
Right.
We have many positions that need to be filled.
Great. We will send some folks your way.
If you give us the opportunity to go down there and have a talk with some of our folks that do the recruiting, to talk to the students about any public service career. Just in my department, we need several trainee attorneys. And we're very small. It's all over the place. And the agencies look towards us to try to find these resources. So I would certainly welcome if there was any type of forum that you could give our agency to try to help your students help the public. I would
absolutely
really appreciate it.
We would love to have you to campus, and we'll start that conversation.
Oh, thank you again so much I'm so honored.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
The Power of Attorney is a production of Rutgers Law School. With two locations just minutes from New York City and Philadelphia, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal, small campus experience. Learn more today by visiting us at law.rutgers.edu.